go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
All right. Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bolin.
Hey, Ben. Today we've got a topic that it kind of came up in a strange manner. You know, we had that podcast about the Rolls-Royce Phantom.
Oh, yes.
And during that, show prep, I was working on some things that I could mention. Now, that show, that there was a lot of information in that show. We didn't get to everything as typical, right?
We never do.
But I had a list of other Phantoms that I thought I would just kind of pepper in there when I had a chance. And topping that list of other Phantoms, which I think I'll read now, by the way. I might as well, right?
Yeah.
And because sure. Let's just get that out of the way. But topping the list was the Phantom Corsair from 1938.
Ah, yes.
And that's today's topic.
And I am so glad we're covering this. Oh, wait, before I start running off at the mouth, do you want to read the rest of the Phantom list?
You know what? Let's go ahead and just do it so that I feel like it's something I have to complete before I can move on. I can't throw this.
Rite of passage.
I just can't throw this piece of paper away.
You should. We got to read it.
And I want to wrap up. There's one at the end here that I think may be a good future podcast topic. Another one. So two from this list of Phantoms, by the way.
Nice.
All right. So how about Phantom Video Games, Phantom of the Opera.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Phantom Fireworks.
Uh-huh.
Phantom Menace, which is the episode one, you know, from Star Wars.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Phantom Pain, which you can have if you lose a limb or finger or something like that, toe,
right.
Whatever. There's a Phantom comic book character.
Mm-hmm. The Phantom.
There's Phantom Jets. And let's see. There's Phantom Power, which is a professional audio equipment term, something I really don't exactly know what that is, but Phantom Power. And this is maybe the final one that I think is another potential podcast topic, and maybe we can get some listeners to chime in on this and tell us what you think. But there's a company out there called Phantom Bikes, and they make bicycles that this guy has retrofitted engines to, sort of like the early days of the motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
So these are like, you know, the roadster style bicycles, you know, the great big wide tires and the big seats and everything with engines in them and a full drive system, you know, a little small tank at the top. They look very retro. They look like old
like
school motorcycles.
The French pre-war motorcycles?
They look just like the early motorcycles, like
wow.
the original Indians and that type of bike.
Oh, wow.
Almost. Similar to that. And there's a company that does nothing but that, and I think that may be a good, you know, future topic for us.
Well, I'm sold.
Yeah. So, all right. I feel much better. I can throw that piece of paper away now.
It's a whole new world,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, but like I said, topping the list was the Phantom Corsair from 1938.
And were he alive today, Rust Hines would be thrilled to hear his car getting some of the coverage that we think it deserves.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we say Rust Hines, yes, we're talking about the infamous 57 – we can't call them infamous. We're talking about the very nice people at the Heinz company, which is known in the United States for ketchup.
Sure, and 57 other things.
Yeah, originally I think there were soups, 57 varieties of
soup.
Oh,
okay, gotcha. Now there's a lot more. I'm sure there's more than 57 at this point.
Yeah, my dad used to lie to me for fun when I was a kid, and one time he told me that there were 57 varieties of ketchup.
Huh?
And that that I, were I to behave better, could try those varieties. And
oh.
I never quite made it.
Well, you know, they tried like blue and red and, mm-hmm. Red, of course they tried red. They tried blue and green and yellow and all kinds of different colors for a while. That didn't,
yeah, you remember that purple one?
Yeah, that didn't seem, not
like
a very
goop.
Good idea.
Yeah.
Not a very good idea. So anyways, this is the heir to the Heinz fortune, right?
Yeah, he's not hurting for money and he, is studying naval architecture at Yale.
Yeah, he's very young. He's at age 22 is when he penned the design for this car
on a napkin, right?
Something like that. Yeah, I mean, apparently on a napkin. I'm not entirely sure of that story.
Yeah,
but
it's apocryphal.
Maybe, but I mean, this guy, he was again naval
architecture.
Is right?
Yep.
That's a strange thing to go into. But
specialized.
He's studying at Yale. He had his own industrial design studio at the time. So I mean, he's clearly on his way, right? I'm sure that a little bit of family money doesn't hurt. But at the time, you know, he had this idea that I'm gonna design a better automobile,
mm-hmm.
something that's completely radically different, right? So he says, I got this idea for a design. Can you guys maybe finance me? Talking to his family,
right?
And
yeah,
his family says no.
they categorically say no. They not only say no, but they say no way, never, except for one family member.
Yeah, that's right. His aunt from Pasadena. Mm-hmm. And his aunt said, you know what, I'll give you I'll float you the cash in order to build a prototype, and we'll see where it goes from there. Because the idea for this thing was not a mass scale production, but more of a slim down or a small scale production vehicle.
Yes.
That, you know, would be released in limited numbers because, as we'll talk about later, but it's rather expensive, as was the prototype. Do you happen to know the prototype dollar amount? Because I've got it here.
The prototype, I know that they set the price point to $14,700.
Yeah, but the prototype cost was somewhere in the neighborhood of they estimate around $24,000 to, you know, upwards of that. So not terribly expensive today's standards, obviously. I mean, when you talk about million-dollar prototypes or more.
If we adjust for...
Adjusted for, yeah. And I you know what? I neglected to do that, but I do have the adjusted dollar amount for the price point for the vehicle later on. We'll talk about it.
Okay.
But again, $24,000, that's an awful lot of money. I'm going to guess somewhere in the neighborhood of, like, you know, $500,000.
Yeah, it's
ballpark.
Quite a bit.
Just a ballpark.
And let's also point out that, of course, his aunt who did help him with the initial capital, she did so over the vociferous protest of the family. What's strange about this story is in the beginning, all of his family members seem really set against him doing this.
Yeah, which I guess, for an architecture student to say that I want to design an automobile, that's a dramatic twist.
It's a switch, sure.
I think so. I don't feel that it I don't think it has the same I don't know, it's not the same school of thought, really. I don't believe so. I mean, someone can write in and tell us different, but to me, that seems, especially when you're talking about, I don't know, what's naval architecture anyways?
Naval architecture sounds as though, I didn't really dig into this too deep, but it sounds as though this could apply to a variety of things. Entirely guessing here, Scott. I would say shipbuilding.
Ship design? That's what I was thinking.
Shipyard. Shipyard design. Well, I think it encompasses all of it.
Okay. If that's the case, because that's kind of what I thought too when I read it, is naval architecture. That's a strange way to say that he designed ships.
Now, we could be completely wrong.
Yeah. But if that's the case, I completely understand the way that this vehicle was designed when you see the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
It, to me, and now it has extremely radical styling for the mid-1930s, late 1930s, because that's when this thing came about. To me, this thing not only looks aerodynamic and streamlined, it looks aquadynamic in a weird way.
Yeah.
It almost looks like a skate or a ray in the way it's designed. I mean, it's a stingray, very much so in the way that it has louvers on the hood. It has a very rounded top, very flat bottom.
Yeah.
We'll get into the specifics of the vehicle later, you know, like the specs and the way it looks. If you haven't already Googled this thing, definitely take a look for it. It's the 1938 Phantom Corsair.
And it has a very smooth, uninterrupted surface.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I mean, it's so completely unexpected for that era of design. I mean, the way that it was laid out, the way that, you know, it was envisioned by him, because it so dramatically varies from what's out there on the roads right then. And you think about cars that had running boards and,
right,
you know, great big fender skirts and
curb finders.
Yeah, I mean, and relatively upright windshields and, you know, they just weren't aerodynamic at all. There were some Art Deco cars at the time, which I'm sure were the influence for him, because this is a very much an Art Deco design.
Yes, he has one small problem. Now, he's already acquired the money he needs. He has his design, and he knows what he wants it to be, but he doesn't build cars.
Yeah, he's got the exterior idea.
Mm-hmm. So in 1936, he meets some very impressive coach builders, Bowman and Schwartz, or that's possibly Schwartz, Bowman and Schwartz, and they are a Duesenberg group. They're known for their outrageous custom Duesenbergs.
Mm-hmm.
They started in 1932. They've done a lot of impressive work. They built a Cadillac station wagon in 1949 for the Mexican president at the time. They also built Duesenbergs for stars, for celebrities.
So they continued on long past the Corsair.
Yes.
Okay.
And so they started with a little vehicle called the Cord 810.
Okay, yeah, the Cord 810. What a great car. I mean, the Auburn Cord, clearly a collector's item. A lot of people, you know, these are very sought-after cars, the Duesenberg line of vehicles. So it's a good place to start, right? I mean, it's an 810 base, so it had a big, heavy chassis.
I mean,
this is a 289 V8, a 4.7-liter engine. I think it had – the original Cord had 125 horsepower, but because of the bodywork that they were going to add to this thing and the you know, just the size of this vehicle, they had to up that to about 190 horsepower just to carry this thing because it weighed around 4,600 pounds, so it was really heavy. I mean, that's like again, back to Rolls-Royce, but that's like their Rolls-Royce limousine weight.
Yeah.
Very, very heavy.
Not exactly a Tata Nano.
No, exactly. I mean, a steel frame.
Mm-hmm.
The crazy thing about this is, you know, of course, it's front engine because there's a ton of room up front, you'll see.
Right.
But it was a front-wheel drive car.
Yeah, that kind of caught me, too.
Well, I think the Duesenberg was, too, at the time. That, you know, the base vehicle was, so there was no change in that.
Mm-hmm.
That was that was something that they just left in place, which made sense, I mean, you know, as far as money goes. But it did have – it had aluminum body panels, Ben. This is really strange with a steel tube frame underneath. Now, this car has made an appearance in a movie.
Now, this is – we're talking the Corsair at this point.
Yeah, the Corsair.
Not the Cord 10.
Now this Corsair has made an appearance in a movie. And what was the movie called?
Young at Heart.
Okay. Now, I've caught clips of this online, but never the full thing. And when they do open the hood of this vehicle, the vehicle's on set.
Right.
They open the hood of it, and you can see the steel tube frame just underneath the hood of this thing. It's a really kind of a triangle shaped hood as it opens.
Yeah.
Kind of a funny movie, from what I can tell. I mean,
yeah, they call the car the Flying Wombat.
The Flying Wombat.
In the movie.
Yeah.
That's the character name.
If you search, you know, the YouTube for the Flying Wombat, you'll find about a 5-minute clip of this thing, and it's done in kind of a corny way. The driving scenes are sped up and kind of funny with hay wagons pulling out of the way real quick,
and they have that thing where it's obviously a screen that's supposed to be the road.
Well, that was probably
cutting edge.
That was cutting edge at the time, I'm sure. But interesting to show this car, and they show it in a dealership where they show many of these things lined up in a row. I think that's a little bit of Hollywood magic because this car is a one of a kind.
Yes.
It never went beyond this, and we'll tell you why, you know, at the end here, but never got beyond, you know, the prototype stage. So this is the Phantom Corsair that we're talking about, and you can go see it today even.
Yeah, this is the only one. And here's the thing, man. So we've spent so much time talking about the exterior and how it really does. I love your comparison to a Ray.
Before we move on, I please tell you something about the exterior, though?
Now,
super aerodynamic, right?
Right.
I've looked at this thing over and over and over again. I mean, when we're prepping for this, we stare at, you know, the subject for a long time, right?
Yeah.
I completely get the Art Deco thing in this vehicle specifically, because I see the lines that they're talking about in the bumpers of it. The bumpers are really cool, by the way. The louvered hood, just expansive hood in front of the thing, the way it's shaped at the back.
Tiny windows.
It's got a separated front and rear. It's bisected. It's cut right in half. Really cool. So it's a split window rear end, a split window front windshield, which was sort of common at the time. Because of the flat glass thing.
Right.
I think it had safety glass, like a triple pane safety glass all the way around.
Yes.
Crazy thing that it did have, another really strange thing, is that it had electric push-button entry, which I thought was really, really unique for the time.
Yes.
So this thing had a lot of unique features to it, including... Well, no running boards we mentioned, but it was fully skirted. All four wheels were completely covered all the way right down to the ground, which was, again, unique. I mean, it was not out of the ordinary to have two wheels covered, you know, the back end maybe.
Right.
But all four wheels for aerodynamic purposes, and I think it had an underbelly pan, a flat underbelly pan. So this thing really, I don't know, it cuts an impressive figure when you look at it.
Yeah, and it's... very low slung, only 57 inches high.
Yeah, but almost 20 feet in length. So you can imagine the proportions of this thing. You said it's 57 inches tall, right?
Right.
20 feet in length and wide. It was really a wide car.
Yes, 76 a little over 76 inches.
Which gets us to the interior. And you were going to tell us about the interior of this thing because it's got some unique interior characteristics as well.
Oh, man.
Really strange.
Okay, so let's first start with the seating arrangement. You know about this, right?
Yes, I do. This is bizarre.
Okay, so the total seats in the Corsair, that's six seats. Two are in the back, and they're by far the cheap seats.
Yeah.
Like, they're the crappy seats.
Yeah, well, those are kids' seats, right?
They're actually kids' seats.
They're
good
for
call.
Children. That's the strange thing. The design is sloped in such a way and cramped and pinched in the back in such a manner that only children can sit in the back. It's that small.
Because the rest of the back is taken up by beverage compartments.
Okay, but you say it seats six.
There we go.
So that means four in the front.
Yes, four in the front, and the driver's not all the way on the end. That's how wide this car is.
This is the most strange part about the seating, I think. Okay, it's four plus two seating, so it's four in the front, two in the rear.
Uh-huh.
You said the driver is not all the way to the left, but it is a left-hand drive car.
It is a left-hand drive car. The car is just so wide that the seat next to the left door is another passenger. So if you're driving this vehicle, you have two passengers sitting on your right and one sitting on your left.
That is so strange. So they said that the bench seat in this thing is more than 5 feet across.
Yeah.
Just the seat itself. That's not accounting, you know, like shoulder room and, you know, all the rest of that stuff. That's just the bench seat itself. It's more than 5 feet wide. So incredible amount of space inside the front of this thing. That's a really weird seating configuration.
And in the
movie, that's not really shown that way.
It's
shown a different way. They have a dummied up dash, obviously, in this thing. It's the movie dash is not the dash of the vehicle. If you look at, you know, you search it online, look at, you know, one of its museum appearances or concourse appearances, and you'll see that the dash is really unique as well. It's got some strange instrumentation.
Yeah, we should mention that the flying wombat you'll see in the film, while the exterior is the Corsair, the interior is not at all. But there's some amazing technology here, especially for the time. The electric push buttons that we've mentioned here, that didn't really happen. Also, it had some instrumentation. Now, this stuff came from the Cord. The original instrumentation came with the Cord, but it also had an altimeter and a compass and
altimeter. This cracks me up every time. It's just a neat thing to put in there. I mean, did you see the position of that? It's right in the center.
Yeah, and it's like why?
It's a cool looking gauge.
Sure.
I mean, I've seen a close up of the gauge itself.
Yeah,
very cool looking. But as far as purpose, nothing really.
Right. If you were ever in a situation where you need that. Maybe it's time to evaluate your life decisions.
But, you know, the Art Deco trend of the time and with the airplane characteristics that they were throwing onto cars and trains and everything else, even furniture or whatever, an altimeter makes perfect sense.
And this is one guy's dream car, too. This car was built to such different specifications. There's no – I'm sorry. I'm getting off on a tangent here, but there's no – market research on Russ Hines's end. He's not interviewing 13,000 housewives and saying, what do you like in a car?
No.
He just thought it would be cool to have an altimeter. That's what happened.
What could I possibly do with this vehicle?
Yeah, and then he also had some really clever stuff where there are alerts that'll let the driver know if the door's open, the radio or the lights are on.
I tell you, Ben, for 1930, that's extremely advanced. That's just another, you know, aspect of this thing that shows that this guy, he was really way ahead of his time in designing this thing.
Yeah.
And, well, we're kind of the point now where we should just mention what happened because, we've told you about all the great attributes of it or most of the great attributes of this car.
Yes.
There's more and more and more to this. I mean, the history of the car is really great. Mm-hmm. If you got more that I'm cutting you off, Ben, please tell me, but, what happened was he himself, Rust Hines, died in a car crash in 1939, like in the summer of 1939. And, you know, this really emerged in 1938.
Mm-hmm.
He drove the car for a short time before his death. He didn't die in this car. He died in another car. He was a car nut, so I don't know exactly what he was doing.
For people keeping track, this puts his time of demise at the very young age of 25.
I know. So, you know, this thing is his idea at 22. He dies at 25 years old. Just tragic, I mean, in all circumstances. I think this guy could have been a fantastic designer if he had lived, I mean, as far as automobile design.
Yeah.
I don't know what he had done for, you know, naval design at the time. I'm not sure what, you know, some of his innovations were there, but I'm sure that there were some, just based on this, what I'm seeing here. Mm-hmm. But I mean, as far as, like, you know, the legacy of the car itself, let's see, he died, okay, again, he died in 1939, 25 years old. He just wanted to launch it into small-scale production. There never was a plan for large-scale production. And, in fact, it had been featured on the cover of a magazine called Motor Age in 1938 in March. So it was kind of on its way. And, of course, you know, then there's the movie that we mentioned a couple times.
Yeah, it was promoted at the 1939 World Fair.
Yeah.
And they took out ads in Esquire, which is where well-heeled car enthusiasts might be reading.
Okay, so it's like the DuPont Registry of today.
Kind of, yeah. I mean,
similar.
They wanted to get that demographic of people who'd actually buy it, because we do need to mention in terms of price.
Ah, this is where I've got my.
This is where we were going, yeah. Right? Okay, so as you and I said before, small scale production, they're thinking somewhere between $14,700 to $15,000 per car.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that in contrast, the Ford Model T was under $500.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like, what was it, $495 or $395 or something like
that?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, the price variance here is amazing. But when you look at this car, I mean, obviously, I mean, of course, it starts with an incredible vehicle for a base vehicle, the Accord 810. And then you take that off and you put on this special body, which makes it even more of a standout.
Mm-hmm.
And all the instrumentation and all the advancements and everything that goes along with it. The asking price of $14,700, is it worth it? I don't know. Because here's the inflation calculator part. All right,
okay,
so
I
went in there and we like to do this. And I didn't do it for the earlier number, the $24,000, but I did it for this. So in 1939, when they were pricing this vehicle, now they already had a brochure, you know, set up, and this is the price that they set for it. But it should be noted that that's also triple the price of a Cadillac V16 sedan of the same era. So a Cadillac V16 would cost, this cost three times more than that Cadillac,
mm-hmm.
Which, as you know, is an extremely sought-after collector car now. But still, there were no orders for this thing at all, which I can't imagine. I don't know why there weren't any orders.
Yeah,
for this
let's emphasize that again. None. There were literally zero orders.
The price may have had something to do with this, because if you adjust the numbers, so 1939, $14,700 is the same in 2012. I couldn't go to 2013. They don't make the calculator yet. but 2012, the same $14,700 is equal to $243,471.13. That's a pricey car.
That is pricey. And you know what's interesting about that is, if we look at that calculation, the kind of cars that cost around $200,000 to $300,000 today are pretty much the small production cars that he was doing. So he was aiming at the right spot. It's just, the question is, was this car so far ahead of its time that it was also ahead of the market?
I think for what he had it slated for, what he had it planned for, I think it was right on the mark. I think this thing could have taken off. I really think, I wish so much that before all this had happened, that there were some orders taken and there was some interest, and then people would have said, you know what, this is worth taking a look at, because the car eventually just kind of traded hands for a relatively cheap price.
Yeah. Are we going to talk about the next? Okay.
I think I want to, because I know where it lives now, and I know kind of like there's a little bit of history that goes along with that too, but it was auctioned and sold, and it was – do you know some of the lower-end prices? Because I don't have any of the dollar amounts that it was actually sold for, but I do know that it changed hands often, and I know whose hands it ended up in – well, second to last and last.
Well, let's see. I've got we know that it was in the Hines family until 1942.
Okay.
When some members of the family started driving it, And then the next thing I've got is in the 50s when it's sold to a comedian.
Yes, I got that information. All right. Okay, so 42 is when the Hines family owned it until 42. There's a dark area here where I don't know what happened to it from 1942 to 1951.
It seems as though somebody who was still in the family was driving it.
Okay.
So they started using it.
Oh, I would buy that. Okay, so this comedian, it's a radio, actually a radio television personality.
Nice.
His name is Herb Schreiner. And Herb Schreiner owned it. He was an investor. He was, like you said, a comedian, but he also invested in real estate and vintage automobiles, that kind of thing were his interests, right?
Yeah.
So was he from? He's from Indiana, I think, right?
And he modified it, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, this is the thing. He modified this thing, and, you know, he's got this big collection of cars. Mm. He just kind of does what he wants with them. He decided he's going to modify it in some way. I don't know exactly what the modifications were, but it was definitely not stock original when it was returned after oh, what?
Yeah, I think I've got one of the modifications.
Sure.
So one of the now, of course, we're giving this car glowing effusive reviews. It wasn't perfect, though. Price aside, it had some overheating, rumor has it, because it had small air intakes. And this was part of the exterior style.
Those little tiny vents on the hood.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the things that Herb changed with Albrecht Goertz. BMW designer.
Okay.
He had the air intake improved and redesigned the windshield.
Okay, you know
that's. I think I don't know what else he did.
Honestly, that seems like a relatively reasonable modification of this thing.
It wasn't tasteful.
He didn't put large like a big fin on the back or anything like that. You know, something crazy or
like
an
air spray of him. You know, wailing on what would he be playing? A trumpet?
Something, ukulele maybe or something. No, he didn't do anything crazy like that then. So he actually did a little resto modding and he improved it a bit. Okay. So anyway, this investor in real estate and vintage automobiles. And, the problem was that, this guy died in 1970. And in fact, he died in a terrible way. He died in a crash. He and his wife, they're killed in Delray Beach, Florida in 1970, when they were driving a Studebaker Avante and the brakes failed. So, this is a bad ending to, Herb Schreiner's life.
Gosh.
But the collection, some of his collection is still on display, at the Auburn Cord Duesenberg Museum in Auburn, Indiana. I've been to that a few times and seen all the cars there. They're gorgeous cars. Love them. So, I guess I've seen these cars in person. I didn't recognize the name Herb Schreiner. I wasn't looking for it.
You were looking at cars,
but I'm sure that they've got the those pointed out as who own them. Now he has a couple of kids, and we'll get into the car went somewhere after 1970. We know where.
Right.
He does have a couple of kids. I just want to mention this because at least two famous kids. He has three kids. One daughter named Indy, named after Indianapolis, Indiana. Mm-hmm. And he has twin sons. One is an actor, comedian, and director, Will Schreiner, who you may know, who was named for Will Rogers. And then there's a soap opera actor named Ken Schreiner, was the other twin. And I think that's about it. That's all I want to say about the kids. But the car itself, where it went after 1970, this is...
This is really cool. This
is another twist in this thing. Do you have some info on it? Because I can
tell
you if you want.
Bit. So William Hara, hotel and casino magnate, I guess is fair to say. Mm-hmm. He's certainly not hurting for money. He's also a big car buff.
Yeah.
And so
I'll tell you just how big in a minute.
Okay. so he wants to get the Corsair, and he wants to take it back to the original. For everybody who remembers our podcast on resto modding that we've done recently, he's on the only original side.
Yes.
And he says, okay, I want to take this. I want to get the windshield, the air intake, and the what have you back to its original state. And that's I don't want to spoil it. That's all I know.
Full restoration of this thing. So, okay, it's back to original condition. And if you don't know anything about William Fisk Hara, this guy, now, he died in 1978. And, of course, you know, the Hara's line of casinos, mm-hmm. hotels, that's his legacy, I guess, that he owned all this. this is where the car collection called the Hera Collection comes from, and it's on display at the National Automobile Museum in Reno, Nevada. Part of his display, of his collection, is on display. And I say part because the collection includes 175 cars, Ben.
Whoa.
That's part of his collection. So, get this. At the time of his death, now William Fisk Hera, like we said, he liked to collect vintage automobiles, right?
Right.
In 1978, he left behind 1,400 automobiles in his collection.
1,400?
He had 1,400 automobiles in his collection. Now, a little bit of everything. Okay, I'm not going to say they're all classics.
Sure.
I don't know that for sure. I've seen photos. I've tried, you know, over the last few days, I've really tried looking at some old photos of, you know, the original Hera's auto collection when he was still alive. So pre-1978.
Okay.
Actually, we should say pre-1980, because in 1980, that's when Holiday Inn chains,
right,
purchased the Hera's name, you know, the brand, I guess, mm-hmm, along with the entire collection of automobiles, all 1,400 of them. And what they did was they decided that they were going to make some money on the collection and continue the, you know, because the hotel chain and the casinos, they still exist.
Right.
So they were successful in keeping that. But the collection, they started to break up, and they broke it up quick. So they auctioned almost every one of the cars except for these 175 that are left that they kept. And that was sold off, you know, or sent to this Hera collection,
sure,
in this museum.
Yeah.
But they did sell, they sold all the rest of them for a profit of about $100 million.
No kidding.
I know, but the splitting up of that collection, I feel is a huge mistake. I mean, that had to have just encompassed everything, the entire evolution of the automobile practically. That's enormous. I think the only other, there's another one that's like double that size somewhere out there. That's like the world's biggest collector.
Right. But we've got I would love to take a look at that, a closer look at that in a different podcast too, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I would love to see even the 175 cars, but then imagine, you know,
1,400.
Yeah. I mean, what, eight times that?
God.
Am I off? Maybe it's 10, no, 9 times, whatever. I'm not
very
good at math.
You're so upset that you're not mathing. But, so the good news is that if you want to see the remaining part of the Hera collection, including our boy, the Phantom Corsair.
Oh, yes.
All you have to do is travel to the National Automobile Museum in, what is it, Scott, Reno?
Reno, Nevada, yeah.
Yeah. And,
I'd love to see that thing.
Wouldn't you?
Okay. This is an odd little tangent here, but I may have been at a show where this thing was, and I just wasn't paying attention.
Are you serious?
Concours d'Elegance, which, you know, this thing, oh, by the way, we should mention that this thing sometimes comes out of the museum and makes the concours circuit.
Yeah, every once in a while. It was at the Goodwood Festival in 06. It's been at Pebble Beach and Amelia Island.
Yeah, and it's been at Meadowbrook. It was at Meadowbrook in Michigan in 2001. Their theme for that year was streamlined cars, I believe, and it was there, and I was there. And I don't know if I can't place it. Like, I can't remember that I saw it, but I was at the same place, and if I had known now, or known then what I know now, I definitely would have given it, you know, a much thorough once-over, I guess. But, like I said, it's definitely worthy of the concours circuit, and it does get out there. So there's a chance to see it outside of Reno, but if you want for sure to see it, definitely make the trip.
Oh, man, that's so crazy. You know what, though, Scott? I don't blame you, because being at a concours has got to be sensory overload.
Oh, it definitely is.
It's not like that's the only car there.
No. But you can find photos of that day or, you know that event and see that it was definitely there. And that's what I did. I kind of looked it up and said, okay, I was there in 2001. It was there. We had to have crossed paths at some point because I saw everything there. But I just don't recall it, you know, specifically.
Oh, man. I've got to do I thought that I was finishing up everything I had to say. Mm-hmm. I really messed up, dude. I have one thing that I was supposed to say at the very beginning.
Oh, what is that?
It's the definition of Corsair. I thought it would be a nice word. All right.
Okay.
Well, let's just get it in there. So a Corsair, for those who are wondering what that word is, it denotes a pirate, specifically a privateer operating along the southern coast of the Mediterranean in the 17th century.
Okay, here's the naval part of the thing, right?
There we go, yeah.
Okay, that's where it ties in. That's why he named it this.
And that should have been at the beginning of the episode. I am so sorry.
Naval architecture, Corsair, it all ties in now. I get it. And, you know, you can buy a matchbox version of this car.
Yes.
And they're not rare. You can buy them on eBay for $5, or you can find them in, you know, a toy store probably, still on the shelf. Mm-hmm. And I think there's even, you know, some larger scale models because people are in love with this car. When you take a look at it and you see some well-done photographs of this thing,
yeah,
it's entrancing.
It's one of a kind.
It's really something that, you know, if you study it and you look at the lines of it, you'll see what I mean by aquadynamic and, you know, the naval influence in this thing, I think. It's a beautiful car.
I can't say it better myself. That's pretty much all I've got for the Phantom Corsair, except that I would really like to hang out there. I don't need to drive it if you're listening in Reno, Nevada. Can I just get a picture with it? I don't know. You got something?
Yes, I do, Ben. I've got a piece of listener mail here. You know what? I think I'm going to go with the postcard first.
Oh.
We received, now this is this is a bit delayed, but over the holidays, we received a postcard from a listener, which is kind of cool. This is really neat. And when I looked at it, we both laughed out loud when we saw this thing.
Oh, yeah, it's funny. Casey laughed too.
It is it looks like a vintage photograph of Shriners in a formation on motorcycles, I guess, but they look like mopeds to me.
Yeah.
But finer, you know, Shriners in full, you know, parade dress, you know, with the hats, the fezzes and everything. Very cool. You know, it's a neat postcard, really. And on the back, the only caption, it says, "What's up with that?"
In big capital letters.
Huge letters, yeah. And it's really, this is it's 22 Shriners on motorcycles in squadron formation. The Tabala Motorcycle Group, or Motorcycle Corps, they do precision maneuvers, that type of things at, shrine events and circus parades, you know, civic parades, things like that. I don't know. It's an interesting thing. I love it when you get stuff like this in the mail. This is so unusual and strange. It came from Shanti Deva, I think is how you say it, in Austin, Texas. So, Shanti, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
This, I promise, this will be tacked up on our office wall here.
Our wall of fame.
Yeah, exactly. I promise you that because this is a really funny photo. So, we like getting stuff like that. If you guys ever, you know, feel like you want to, please send something like that along.
Yeah, and just to prove the point, I'm going to go ahead and write down precision cycling and Shriners for a possible podcast name.
Oh, yes, and we can't forget the little go-karts.
Yes, we can't.
Shriner vehicles are really cool.
You know what? Let's just make a Shriner vehicle.
Shriner vehicles,
All right, so we're going to head out. We hope you guys have enjoyed our podcast on the Phantom Corsair. Please let us know if you've seen it in real life. If you're that guy who got to drive it,
oh, man.
Did you see that clip?
That is such a lucky guy. I mean, just the right place, right time. That's what it is.
I'm sure he worked for it.
That's what it comes up down to, really.
But let us know, not just your take on the Phantom Corsair, but if you have any other historically unique vehicles that you would like to hear about, or heck, just drop a line to say hello. You know, there's no pressure. You can find us at Facebook. You can drop us a line on Twitter, or you can send us an email directly at
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.